This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. It's tax season, and we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's one you need to hear. $16.5 billion. That's how much the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud last year. Now here's a good number. 100 million. That's how many data points LifeLock monitors every second. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it, guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year at LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hope you had a fantastic weekend. I did. Thanks to everyone in St. Louis for coming out on 97.1. That was big support of the show and all the anchors and all the hosts that did such a great job. We're back in action today with all the breaking news that is taking place over the weekend. Literally, it took 6 hours off to prepare for the Fox Nation show that was aired live, and that I think I missed out on what normally would be a month worth of news. And there's a lot happening. Neil Chatterjee is going to be with us today, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under Trump 1. He's going to tell us about what they're meeting about last week. They had the energy executives in there for the first time in 4 years. I wonder why. And then we got Andy McCarthy back from vacation, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. With all the legal action, we need to speak to Andy. First, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The message is also clear to Iran. We have the capabilities. Our allies have capabilities. And we are strong and united together today. That's American leadership. That's President Trump putting America first.
Yep. Massive foreign policy offensive with the whole Trump team bombing the Houthis in Yemen. Seriously. Warning Iran to break down your nukes or else. Plus, ceasefire talks with Ukraine and today, Russia and Saudi Arabia and back in the IDF as they are pounding and holding land inside Gaza to take out Hamas. Not hurt them, take them all out.
Number two.
I wasn't calling for violence, and it's ridiculous that I even have to say something like that. But because they are trying to twist our words, one of the things that I told people to do is make sure you are adhering to the laws.
Really? I think something differently, and you had to scramble to get back on TV because the AG told you that they'll be watching to see what happens as Tesla is front and center. And Elon Musk, they're under fire, but they seem more than equipped to survive and, dare I say, thrive as Dems use Elon to fuel big crowds and foment big-time left-wing anger.
Number one.
They were standing up cheering. The president walked over to me and he says, they absolutely love me here, don't you? And I said, sir, they do. And he says, why do you think that? And I said, they respect a fighter and they respect you. And he just said, yeah, I get that.
Yeah, Trump agenda. Rousing welcome for Trump as at the NCAA Wrestling Championships. And he'll be grappling in the courts all week as the judges line up to block his agenda or at least listen to it as he tries to appeal the process. Andy, welcome back.
Brian, great to be with you.
Hey, first off, could you give me, as I sit down here and realize you're on Zoom, if you're watching at home, you can watch. Go to the app, click on watch. Well, the camera will pan down eventually. Click on watch, and you could see us go head-to-head. Andy, first off, as you see that the president is flying a week ago, 261 people into El Salvador, ICE put him there to their MS-13, their TDA, and now a judge says, wait a second, turn that plane around. That judge still has a multiple hearings, not satisfied with the Justice Department answer to it. At the same time, there's an appellate process to hear about the holding off of future flights. First off, on the judge's decision to hold back the flights, did he make the right move?
Well, the president's authority under that statute is very dubious. I don't think, in principle, there's no problem with shipping Venezuelan gang members out of the United States. The question is whether he can do it under this vehicle, the Alien Enemies Act, which is really intended for declared wars and has only been invoked three times in the history of the United States. So, you know, unlike some of the judges, Brian, who have done some pretty outrageous things, Judge Boasberg is not a crazy person. I don't know that you and I would agree with his politics, but he's a pretty straight shooter as a judge. He's, you know, was originally put on the D.C. court, not the federal district court, but the D.C. court by George W. Bush, President Bush 43. And he was put on the FISA court by Chief Justice Roberts. So he's not, you know, he's not a maniac or a nut like some of these other, I don't like to refer to judges that way, but some of the other judges' rulings have been pretty out there. This one, you can understand why the courts are going to scrutinize it. And I think the big problem that we're going to deal with respect to getting people out of the country is basically, while the law says that an illegal alien is supposed to be in prison, detained during the course of the proceedings against him to determine whether he gets kicked out of the country or not, we only have, according to what Reuters reported last week, 47,600 spaces for detainees for immigration purposes in the United States. And it's hard to kick people out of the country if you can't stash them someplace while the proceedings go forward.
So a couple of things. Why do they need proceedings? Because we can't possibly do this at this rate. We have 8 million who came in over the last 4 years. There's 22 million, a low estimate on how many illegals are actually here. So these guys are picked up for a reason locally, ideally. Then ICE has called them. The ICE has said, okay, there's enough here and enough here to keep them. Now what do I do with them? Do I put them in our supermax or do I send them back to where they came from? So along the way, if we have to allow these guys to lawyer up and we have to go through proceedings, it's not practical or logical. And I don't know if a guy who sneaks in here illegally deserves that. What do they deserve, do you in
well,
your mind?
Well, if you're asking me as a matter of cosmic justice, what do they deserve? I'm with you. I think we should kick them the hell out of here. But unfortunately, I don't run the country, and Congress has enacted a lot of law in this area in over the last number of decades. So even if you have people who are illegal aliens who are in the country and who are picked up and are instantly removable, they are still entitled to a removal hearing in front of an immigration judge. And all of these Venezuelans, there was about, I think the final tally, Brian, was like 267 or 269 of them was the number. So some of them are in immigration proceedings. Some of them are criminal defendants who had criminal charges against them. So what due process they get hinges on the reason that they were being detained in the first place.
Yeah.
And the reason the president wants to invoke this particular law is if he's right about this and he gets to say what is an invasion or what is a predatory incursion in the United States, then he can cut through all that stuff and get them out of the country. That's the reason he wants to use this law. The question is whether he can. And number one, whether there is an invasion or a predatory incursion as a matter of law. And secondly, who gets to make that decision? And the question is, does the court get to make that decision or is it the president?
So a couple of things. If you sneak in illegally, I can send you back to your country, right?
Yes, but like you have to – there's a process. It's supposed to be a quick process, but it's still a process.
That's why we want you to remain in Mexico so you don't become our problem. So,
right, exactly.
So here's the thing. This guy, a guy gets picked up. Cop says, I caught you in the act, whatever that act was, whether it was assault, rape, whatever it was. And then he goes, ICE, this guy doesn't belong here. It's his immigration status. Okay, I got him. Is that enough to, in front of a judge, this is what two cops said, or local cops and the ICE cops. They said, yeah, this is what we have on him. But if you in our country, you're innocent to proven guilty. I haven't proven anything. We got him. So what do I do with him?
Two different things, right? One is the crime. So you're right. As far as the crime is concerned, if they wanted to charge him with whatever crime he committed, you have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And you can detain him pre-trial, for example, if he doesn't have ties to the United States, which is the case with illegal aliens. There are high risks of flight for the purposes of the criminal proceeding. In the immigration proceeding, the only thing that matters is, does he have a legal right to be here or not? But the problem is, and we saw this millions of times in connection with the Biden administration, they can claim asylum. They can claim, like, if you send me back to my country, I'm going to be persecuted, or the following, 10 terrible things are going to happen to me. And unfortunately, that triggers a process in the United States. It can be done in an accelerated pace, but the problem is that would be fine if we had like 100 people in this category. We have 20 million. So that's the problem. I mean, we have
right,
too
but
many.
How many are criminals? That's what I'm well, saying. So like you know, commit the crime. Like some people are just here and they're yeah, working as cooks, and I'm not saying it's right, but that's so much different than picked up by cops, multiple offender, known rapist in our country, raping again. So I have to watch this guy go get a lawyer?
No, well, let me tell you what that goes to, right? What you just mentioned now is what goes to prosecutorial discretion and who gets up highest on the list. You know, if we only have the resources to get rid of, say, a million people out of 20 million, what the administration wants to do, and they're right about this, is prioritize the criminal aliens. So they're looking for the people who yep. have committed crimes. Other than the ordinary crime, you know, coming into the country illegally is a crime. It's a misdemeanor, but it's still a crime. So I have a problem with the category of criminal alien because in my experience, and this is as a prosecutor for a long time, it's not only a crime to come into the United States. They typically commit a number of crimes, including, you know, identity fraud yeah. and that kind of stuff. So they're all committing crimes in one way or another. But I think what we're talking about are people like these gang members who commit actual violent crimes that are yeah. independent of like just being an illegal alien in the United States. And those are the people the president wants to prioritize. And I think he's as frustrated as you are, as I am, as everybody is about the fact that we have too many people who are here who shouldn't be here because of the last administration. But we have very finite resources in terms of what we can turn on them to get them out of the country. And he would like to cut through all that. And that's why I mm-hmm. think he's invoking this Alien Enemies Act. The problem is it's very sketchy whether that law fits the situation or not.
All right. So this judge seems to be focused on logistics. Why couldn't you turn your plane around? What exactly? What plane was in the air? What? Where was the flight pattern? I have a FlightAware app. I'm comparing it. Instead of trying to solve the problem and say what could be the system of things you go through in order to find out who's qualified to be flown out of here into a supermax prison, this judge seems obsessed with that. And does it bother you at all that the FISA case that he's best known for is the Kleinsmith case, where this guy knowingly lied on a FISA application and he got a slap on the wrist and no jail time? That, to me, it shows he qualified for the FISA court, according to John Roberts. I don't love what he did.
Well, I don't know. I don't love what he did. That was in a criminal case. I thought Kleinsmith should have got a heavier sentence. On the other hand, I also think John Durham, who's a friend of mine, I think he should have been charged more severely.
Okay,
from than that he was also. Report. And as far as the other thing is concerned, Brian, I have to say, you know, being a prosecutor for a long, long time, if a judge asks you a question, you got to answer the question, right? So I do think that Boasberg is trying to get to the bottom of the legal question. That's what the argument in court was about on Friday. But he's angry because they lied to him in court. And
they didn't answer him. How would they lie? How'd they lie?
Well, I mean, look, the first part of the hearing, the prosecutor says, I don't have any information, right? He tells the prosecutor, go back and get information. And then the prosecutor comes back and he says to him, all right, now what's going on with the planes? And he says, I don't have any information. And in the meantime, the planes had taken off. So he sent the prosecutor back to tell the people that, you know, number one, the judge is going to put in a 14-day pause so we can get to the bottom of whether legally they can do this or not. And I want an update on what's going on with these people. And he feels like they played games with him. And I don't blame him for that. And any federal judge would do that to any prosecutor who if he thought that they were playing games in front of him and not giving him honest answers.
And now it's in front of an appellate court, right? Three judges are going to decide, right?
1:30 this afternoon, right?
And what's at stake?
Well, it's a very weird proceeding because usually once the Court of Appeals takes jurisdiction over something, the proceeding should stop in the lower court. So I don't understand why they're still having proceedings in the lower court until the D.C. Circuit decides what they're going to decide. It's very peculiar.
It was confusing to me, too. Muhammad Khalil, he is the 31-year-old graduate student who graduated from Columbia, who's been accused of being pro-Hamas, Sinwar pictures, other pictures of Nasrallah. They're not Palestinian. These are Hamas-known gang terrorist groups. New allegations in order to finally get him out. He's in an ICE facility in Louisiana. He did not disclose in his application to come here on his visa that he was working with UNRWA or that, in fact, he was for the divestiture group, that big divest from Israel group. He failed to list his continuing employment with Syria office in the British embassy. And these are the things that were entered into his case that's going to be heard in New Jersey. Why do we have to go through this? He's at an American university causing consistent unrest. He's at the hub of it, the nub of it. Why do we even have to go and prove this?
Well, we shouldn't have to. Now, unlike the statute we were just talking about, the Alien Enemies Act, which is a kind of a controversial invocation of that statute, I think this one should be a layup, even though the courts and the left are bristling at it. The statute says that the Secretary of State can make a decision that a person who's been given a visa to come to the United States, his continued presence here causes problems for us on foreign relations, on foreign policy. And the statute gives the Secretary of State the authority to make that judgment call. Rubio made it. So all the stuff that you just laid out, Brian, the new information, that gives us additional reasons why he should be put out of here expeditiously. But I actually think that, you know, the idea that Rubio can't do this is ridiculous because the statute gives him that authority.
Andy, thanks so much. It was fantastic to talk to you. No more vacations. All right. I need to talk to you every day.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Leader Schumer, are you feeling pressure to step down?
Look, I'm not stepping down.
Are you making the same mistake that President Biden did?
No, absolutely not.
Chuck Schumer asked repeatedly by everybody, and now that he's on a book tour, he's everywhere, also having to show that he has so-called fight, air quotes, everybody wants him to step down. And to me, it's like having a bad day at work and coming in and getting mad at your family. Chuck Schumer is not the problem with Democrats. I am not a fan of his. Never done anything proactive. He's always blocking or pretending as if we got to get rid of the filibuster, pretending as if we got to add two states in emergency, pretending we got to fatten the Supreme Court, talking about how corrupt they, all that stuff. But to me, that's nothing proactive. There's nothing out of the box. That's typical him. And then he realizes we're going to get shut down and closed down, and it's going to be Democrats' fault. So he says, all right, there you go. Well, here's your votes. We'll pass the CR, which is mostly a Joe Biden budget. So listen, now they're going to just beat up on him, AOC and Bernie Sanders. Go ahead. They were protesting outside his house in New York City. So good luck with that. You can blame all you want. Neil Chatterjee is next. We're going to talk a little about oil and gas and energy, the failure of wind, and where they go from here, trying to be the number one supplier of Europe now that they have to stop buying from the evil empire we call Russia. Don't move. 1-866-408-7669 to call after that. So in 15 minutes, line up on the phone.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The fastest growing energy source on the planet over the last 15 years is natural gas. The planet is increasingly getting powered by natural gas. And it's the second largest U.S. export after oil and oil products, and it's our fastest growing export. So it's tremendously positive for the U.S. economy. And boy, what I released earlier today was the previous administration had a report that they had produced that showed increased LNG exports would have negligible price impact on domestic gas prices and would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. They didn't like that answer. They buried the study.
Yep, and Fox News independently reviewed the copy of that study, Energy Economic and Environmental Assessment of LNG, and the report said its findings were slated for publication in 2023. Everything that Chris Wright, the energy secretary, said last week was 100% true. And that's what they found in New York. When they wanted to see the impact of fracking and natural gas on the environment in New York, they found no impact, but they didn't do it anyway. No impact, but they didn't do it anyway because the ideology of windmills and electric cars were too much to overcome, and that would have hindered their agenda, which you think was to save the planet. But if you see the way they're attacking the Tesla cars and blowing up electric cars and the showrooms, as well as the fleets, you could see there's nothing sincere in my view about it. Neil Chatterjee joins us now, former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under President Trump. Neil, welcome back. When that study hit, I was not that surprised because that's what I hear about natural gas. Were you?
I wasn't surprised at all. I mean, what we saw clearly during the Biden administration is they didn't know which way they wanted to go, and they talked out of both sides of their mouth. On the one hand, they understood, or at least you had some people that understood in the president's circle that natural gas was saving the economy. I mean, think about where our economy would be without natural gas. Natural gas just saved the economy. And then they had a foreign policy component to it where they really wanted U.S. natural gas to give our allies in Europe an alternative to piped in Russian gas. And so you had some folks around Biden who were pushing for exports. But then you had folks in the base, in the Democratic base, who are just anti-fossil fuel zealots, who just ignore the fact that U.S. LNG, because we do it cleaner and better than anyone else, actually would displace dirty Russian gas and dirtier sources of fuel in places like Southeast Asia and would actually help the climate. It was the most frustrating thing in the world for me to watch over the past few years. So that's my long-winded way of saying I was not shocked at all to hear that they suppressed the results of that study.
All right, so now we're going to do it. We're trying to get all hands on deck, and we're trying to get natural gas over to Europe. Can you bring it practically? Are we able to do that? Because we have now, we no longer are giving our European allies a waiver to buy Russian natural gas. They're going to have to buy it from, I hope, us. Are we capable of giving it to them?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, there's a long lead cycle for these kinds of things. And honestly, it was a lot of the good work that went on in the first Trump administration that have put us in this position. Look, not to pat myself on the back, but when I was chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, I approved 12 permits for liquefied natural gas facilities. And then Secretary of Energy Rick Perry and Secretary of Energy Dan Brouillette put those in motion. So some of those plants are gearing up and getting ready. We also approved additional shipments from existing U.S. LNG export facilities. The Biden administration slowed things down a little bit because they put a pause in place on new permits, but they couldn't stop us from doing the good work we had already done to date. So we're pretty well positioned to meet this moment and meet this demand. And I think the one positive impact right off the bat, not even on January 20th, just after the election, the clear signal that was sent that U.S. LNG would be supported was enough to kind of stimulate the markets to say, hey, now is the time to really capitalize on this golden opportunity for America.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I hear we have trouble getting enough ships. That could be one thing. And because of the Jones Act, we have trouble delivering natural gas to other states, which I found odd that we can't address. I mean, is I was talking to Governor Sununu. They were frustrated in the New England area.
Yeah, New England's tricky because of the Jones Act, because of the lack of pipeline capacity that can get gas into
which is a choice, right?
Which is a choice. Look, our domestic politics always create complications in this system, but when it comes to LNG exports, we're quite good at it. The situation in New England, honestly, what we need there is legislative permitting reform out of Congress. It's too hard to build things in this country. New England needs natural gas pipelines to bring gas into New England, where they rely on it not just for home heating, but also for electricity, particularly in really
cold
winter.
And you need states' permission, Neil, to do this, because that's what Governor Hochul, she wants all this Penn Station money and wants all these deals. He says, let me put a pipeline through your state. How valuable would that be?
I mean, look, we've got all of this gas in Pennsylvania. I mean, just, you know, a tremendous supply. And we can't get it into the northeast of our own country because it's being blocked. It's so frustrating. I think there's a deal to be cut. We need transmission lines in this country as well to get more clean energy onto the grid. I think there's a deal to be had to get a permitting reform agreement in place that better enables us to build stuff in this country, both natural gas pipelines and electric transmission lines, which are both desperately needed.
What about the pipeline that you guys proposed through Europe, but France stopped it because of the Alps and they were concerned about conservation? They might be changing their mind now because of Russia.
Yeah, but it's by the time they get through their processes, the opportunity for the U.S. Is so significant. What we really need, quite frankly, is to solve some of these issues, to cut down the transportation time it takes to get U.S. cargoes to Europe and, more importantly, to Asia. We haven't been able to build a terminal on the west coast of this country, again, because of domestic political opposition.
Because California doesn't want to do it.
California doesn't want to do it. Oregon doesn't want to do it. Our big opportunity, there was an LNG facility that we were going to site when I was at FERC in Oregon that would have been able to economically and geopolitically serve the Asian market, serve Japan, our ally. And we couldn't get it through because of domestic political opposition. It would have been huge for the economy, for our geopolitical standing, and for the environment.
How do you feel about some of these tensions between the U.S. and Canada and how that could affect oil and gas?
You know, I think President Trump understands how to play the tariff negotiations, right? And I think Americans have got to give him the benefit of the doubt here. This guy has been talking about tariffs since the 1980s. We've already seen him have success in kind of challenging even our allies, you know, in these tariff negotiations. I think he understands the energy implications. I think he understands what it could mean for electricity prices. I'm going to trust him to execute on these negotiations.
Neil, what price does oil and gas have to be for drilling to start? Because I understand I've got educated on just the business a little bit, where the amount that banks have to invest in, the likelihood of finding oil and everything that has to go into it, the permitting and the building and the insurance. And you're worried about the administration losing momentum for oil and gas and fossil fuels. Right now you have one that's very friendly to it. But people told me if gas is over, if it's under $70, it doesn't a barrel, it doesn't pay to drill. What's the reality?
So I'm not an expert on the oil side. I focus on natural gas. And I will tell you, as natural gas has become more critical to electricity and electric power in the U.S., and we are about to see a huge surge in demand for electricity being driven by AI and data centers and cloud computing and quantum computing and streaming services and crypto and Bitcoin mining and reshoring American manufacturing, All of this is going to require a tremendous amount of electricity, and natural gas can play a major, major role in that. And so I think that will drive demand for natural gas. But I referenced the situation in Pennsylvania. You know, we've got, you know, the Marcellus, we've got, you know, we've got the Utica Shale, we've got, you know, in Texas and the Dakotas, we have so much domestic supply. I fundamentally believe we can meet the coming surge in demand for natural gas while also keeping prices affordable for Americans. But we got to have more infrastructure. We got a lot of trapped gas right now because we haven't been able to build the pipelines to get it moving, to get it transportable. And so if we can solve our infrastructure challenges, our permitting challenges in this country, we can further unleash the power of natural gas.
Well, where are we at now with the infrastructure? Is there, besides talking about it, obviously the Trump, you're a Trump guy, they must realize it. Do you think the new energy secretary realizes it? Are they doing anything about it?
Oh, of course. Energy secretary realizes it. The interior secretary realizes it. The chairman of FERC realizes it. They're all working towards it. But that's why we need Congress to kind of step in with that legislative permitting reform, because at the end of the day, there's only so much you can do with executive action. We've got to figure out ways to overcome some of these state and local objections to building infrastructure if we want to have an America in which energy is both reliable and affordable. If we want energy dominance, we've got to figure out ways to make it easier to build things in this country, both natural gas pipelines, natural gas generators, but also, look, you know, solar and getting transmission lines built to get solar onto the grid and storage. These are all things that we need, and that is why I think there is room for bipartisan compromise in Congress. Both parties, Democrats who right now are opposing anything and everything that the Trump administration and Republicans propose, they ought to realize there is a golden opportunity for them long term to cut a deal with Republicans to make it easier to build things in this country.
That would be interesting. I mean, that's a positive agenda the political folks could talk about in the Senate and the House. They're looking for something to maybe get on board with. That might be something they can do, might be helping everyone. Neil, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, as always.
All right. As you know, natural gas reports show does not hurt the environment. So let's start fracking. Back in a moment.
Taking America back.
Our long national nightmare is over.
One executive order at a time.
I ended the paper straw.
You! Okay, he's right on this one.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
How does that idea that Democrats didn't lose to Trump, they lost to the couch, sit with you?
It's just not empirically correct. Generally, turnout and support go in the same direction for the basic reason that there are a lot of people who didn't feel ready to vote for a Republican, but were still mad at the Democratic Party, and so they stayed home in response. And if you just look at the demographics of who these people are who voted for Biden last time and stayed home this time, they're generally low education. They're fairly politically disengaged. They're much less likely to watch shows like MSNBC and more likely to watch shows like Fox. And they frankly just look a lot like the voters who trended away from us.
So if you had forced them out to vote, they may have just voted for Donald Trump.
Right. Exactly. And that does show up. You know, if you look at African-Americans, for example, African-Americans who didn't vote were much more likely to say that they supported Trump than the ones that did this cycle. It's true that overall turnout fell in a lot of the country, but in the battleground states that actually decided the presidential election, turnout was roughly where it was from 4 years ago. And it just is clear as day that a bunch of people changed their mind.
Yeah, and that was David Shore. He wrote a book with Ezra Klein. They were talking about it in the podcast. He's a Democratic pollster. This is the reality portion of our political cycle before people refuse to say that or not get interviewed about that because it would hurt their party. And that's what David Shore is saying, that people should understand what's really going on in the country. And that plays into what I believe is a total head fake for people not paying attention. You see the big crowds that AOC is getting. You see the big crowds that he and Bernie Sanders are getting. The anti-oligarch crowd. What are you talking about? No one's talking about oligarchs, successful people rallying around a successful candidate. Nobody hates billionaires. You could try to vilify billionaires, but what they're saying is so important. What they're saying is they're giving you the woke garbage. They're telling you the rich are bad people not paying taxes. They're telling you that a billionaire is giving tax breaks to their billionaire friends. All inaccurate catchphrases that don't resonate anymore. What are you doing at the border? What are you doing about inflation? What are you doing about bringing costs down? What are you about doing about the four international hotspots that Joe Biden left in flames for this incoming administration? What is your answer for doing that? Here's more from David Shore. Cut 39.
Generally, what you see now is that every measure of socioeconomic status and political engagement is just monotonically related to your chance of liking Trump.
What is monotonically related?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Just that.
This is why Democrats can't win.
That's exactly right. I'm the problem. But it's basically just that the more, even the lowest, you know, political engagement categories, the lowest education categories, you know, the poorer, the lower socioeconomic status, the less engaged you are in politics, now the more Trump you are. And that just wasn't true 4 years ago.
You understand? So you go ahead and you tell a group of people that oligarchs have it too good and then Trump's in it for himself. Why do working class people like him? Why do you keep saying the same things? Yes, there's going to be people that Bernie Sanders brings to gets a big crowd for. You know who else did? Ron Paul got a big crowd, but he's not electable. Bernie Sanders gets big crowds. AOC is a junior socialist. With more charisma, no social media. But there's nothing national about her policies. There's nothing in the I accomplished it column in her life that makes you think she's a national figure. You have Josh Shapiro who's going to try to run in a battleground state that gave an interesting interview to Bill Maher last weekend where he talks about some commonalities that he has with the Republicans and where they're different, where he feels it's different about how they're cutting programs and how he does it different. To me, that's what people want to hear. Don't pretend that just say, well, Donald Trump didn't get that much of a that his win wasn't that big, and he didn't get 50% of the popular vote. Listen, over 300 electoral votes, every battleground state, every category he improved, every state he gained ground, including in blue states. So you could spin it any way you want. But when the door closes, you have to come up with a game plan. The Bernie Sanders AOC game plan is a loser.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. Gerard Baker at the bottom of the hour, and he's from the Wall Street Journal. They got a big story out today about the tariffs and what the truth will be and how they're paring back. And I think that's why the market is responding. There is 477 points right now. And as I come to you from New York City, so that's right down. Michael Goodman with the New York Post is standing by. And by the way, it's so interesting that they're going to have an Easter roll, and it's going to be corporate sponsored. Trump can't help but do the right thing when it comes to it. Hey, we're having an Easter roll. There's going to be all these cameras down here. What corporation would like to be a part of the fun? Yes, if you're looking to balance the budget, you got to be smart. I know it's not going to help with $36 trillion directly, but little by little, that's the mindset. So before we get to Michael, big three.
Number three.
The message is also clear to Iran. We have the capabilities. Our allies have capabilities. And we are strong and united together today. That's American leadership. That's President Trump putting America first.
Massive foreign policy offensive with the whole Trump team. Bombing the Houthis, seriously, in Yemen. Warning Iran, break down your nukes or we'll break it down. Plus ceasefire talks with Ukraine and Russia. Ukraine yesterday, Russia today, and Saudi Arabia. And back in the IDF as they decide to move in hard into Gaza with more armaments than they had during the whole Biden reign.
Number two.
I wasn't calling for violence, and it's ridiculous that I even have to say something like that. But because they are trying to twist our words, one of the things that I told people to do is make sure you are adhering to the laws.
Tesla, and Musk under fire, but they seem more equipped to survive and, dare I say, thrive as Dems use Elon to fuel big crowds and foment big-time left-wing anger.
Number one.
They were standing up cheering. The president walked over to me and he says, they absolutely love me here, don't you? And I said, sir, they do. And he says, why do you think that? And I said, they respect a fighter and they respect you. And he just said, yeah, I get that. I get that.
That is Mark Wayne Mullen, senator from Oklahoma. Trump agenda, a rousing welcome for Trump at the wrestling championships in Philadelphia. And he'll be grappling in the courts all week as the judges line up to block his agenda. And that's going to be interesting because today we're going to see that he's in an appeals court to try to get permission for future flights into Supermax prisons in El Salvador because he's having trouble in a district court, which you'll have a hearing on Tuesday, about whether or not he could have turned around those flights full of TDA as well as MS-13 that were good. They're now in El Salvador as we reinvigorate flights back to Venezuela. I don't know why they're all of a sudden accepting them back again. So we'll see where that goes, because what they've done at the border is flat out extraordinary. 96% decrease since Joe Biden left office. Michael Goodwin joins us now. Michael, welcome back. First off, there was a big win, I think, for the president on Friday and the administration. And it happened at Columbia, where they said, if you want your $400 million back because you refuse to clamp down on anti-Semitism and pro-Hamas efforts on your campus, you better make some changes. They gave them 9 changes. Looks like Columbia did all 9.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Yes, I think this is a really significant victory for taxpayers above all, because, and for students at these schools, because Columbia is really a test case. It was sort of the center of a lot of the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic riots and takeovers and protests across many campuses. And for the president to bring Columbia to the table and say, look, unless you stop violating your requirement under the Civil Rights Act, this is the Civil Rights Act that requires schools to protect all students from harassment and any kind of intimidation. And clearly Columbia failed to do that. They're still failing to do that. I mean, we saw that just recently at Barnard, which is affiliated with Columbia. And so this test case, really, of we're going to withhold a large portion of your federal contracts and grant money, in this case $400 million, unless you agree to a set of conditions, including that students in protest cannot wear masks unless it's a real health issue because they're doing it just to not identify themselves. You must give your campus police arrest power. And in Columbia's case, you had these two departments that have long been hotbeds of anti-Semitism that you effectively have to put some kind of overseer on them to straighten them out. And these and several other smaller agreements is part of this. But Columbia essentially surrendered, said yes. Now, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's fascinating, Brian. All the other, the president of Princeton, the New York Times, others are denouncing Columbia for surrendering. That's great. Don't surrender. Lose the money. Let the taxpayers keep the money. Let's see how long your university is considered a high-flying, successful research university. I think one of the things that's amazing here, Brian, most people did not understand the connection between federal dollars and these big elite institutions. Donald Trump did, to his credit. And by taking away the money, he cracked their resistance. And I think he will do the same at Harvard, at Penn, at Northwestern, on and on and on.
Well, he got Pennsylvania. He got University of Pennsylvania because he would not get rid of trans men in women's sports. So he cost him $175 million. I also like some simultaneously, Secretary of State Rubio is in the process of kicking out Mahmoud Khalil, who's a 31-year-old graduate student who graduated. Somehow he gets to Columbia, where all these kids who are 150 305 averages with near-perfect SATs, can't get in. But this guy gets in as a refugee from Syria hanging out in London, and he comes here and he foments unrest in the university. And now he goes from Louisiana, where he's writing defiant letters from the ICE facilities. Now he's going to be heard in court. And now Secretary of State Rubio, according to Andy McCarthy, didn't even have to do this. He says he lied about his visa to get here and to get a green card. He lied. He didn't disclose that he worked for UNRWA or told Columbia University that he was part of the apartheid divest from Israel movement. He failed to list continuing employment with the Syria office in Britain's embassy in Beirut. And they're pushing back. They want to kick him out. There's also a kid up in a young man up at Cornell. Same thing. Knew it would jeopardize his visa status. Still continued to protest pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian. He's gone. A professor over at Georgetown. He's in the process of being deported. This is what's got to happen.
Absolutely. Look, I quoted in my column a Supreme Court Justice, Arthur Goldberg, who may have been the second person to use this, but it is, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. Our Constitution does not require us to bring people into our country who want to destroy our country. We don't have to do that. That's not part of the Constitution. And so this idea that all these people have free speech rights and all of that, sure they have free speech rights, but not when they're siding with terrorists, not when that speech is fomenting revolution against the government of the United States and against our national interest and our foreign policies. It's very clear there are limits. And, of course, it's remarkable, Brian, the Biden administration did not use any of these powers. Don't forget, all of these things that we're talking about now happened while Joe Biden was president. He did nothing about it. In fact, as I argue in the column, he actually took the same side of many of these protesters by repeatedly criticizing Israel. Kamala Harris did the same thing. They protected these students because they basically agreed with American policy, which was Israel was the problem, not Hamas.
And he thought that the woke agenda.
That's fundamentally what's going on here.
He thought the woke agenda, the anti-Israel agenda, was something that's going to get him, keep him in the White House, when the Democrats still haven't woken up to the fact that we don't see the eye to eye with Hamas. We don't think October 7th was okay. That was fomented by Israeli suppression. In fact, Steve Witkoff is also fed up. Listen to what he said over the weekend. Israel now is going all in and holding ground from here on in Gaza. They realize just wounding or hurting Hamas isn't enough. They have to wipe them out. They also have gone in through the corridor right in the middle. Listen to Steve Witkoff say, you know exactly who's to blame. Cut 25.
The United States stands with the state of Israel. There's just... That's a 100% commitment, and we've expressed that. Hamas had every opportunity to demilitarize, to accept the bridging proposal that would have given us a 40 or 50 day ceasefire where we could have discussed demilitarization and a final truce. There were all kinds of opportunities to do that, and they elected not to.
And that's why they're going in. And even though in Israel they're tired of war, Netanyahu can't see any other way but to get rid of them. And now Egypt says they might take up to 500,000 Palestinian refugees, which if they follow through on that, that would be a significant win for the administration.
Absolutely. That would be roughly a quarter of the entire population of Gaza. And I'm sure other countries will be pressured to take some, Jordan, maybe even Qatar, right? They're so happy to support Hamas. Why don't they ship them 100,000 Gazans and see how they like that? Look, I think what's consistent throughout these things, Brian, that we're discussing is Donald Trump is a man of action. He doesn't just inherit a problem and say, well, there's nothing we can do about it. He is attacking. He's on offense with these problems. And he's not afraid to use the power of the presidency to make things happen for the better. And I think this is so refreshing. I mean, you watch even members of the administration when they go on these television, these hostile interviews with CBS and NBC and CNN, they push back.
They do.
They don't just sit there like the old Republicans and take it on the chin and sort of apologize for their differences. They push back. And I think that's what Donald Trump has done. He has enlivened this idea that we don't have to put up with this anymore. We're going to fight back. We're going to use the power of the presidency to help the American people, to put America first. I mean, when you think about all of these colleges and universities letting in all of these foreign students, many of whom are the ones out there wearing keffiyehs and banging drums and calling for the end of Israel and supporting terrorism, why would we put up with that? Why have we put up with that for so many years? I mean, it is refreshing. And as I say in the column, Trump hitting them where it hurts, in the pocketbook. I mean, without federal money, these schools could not exist as we know them now. And that's what he's doing. And I think it's going to work as much as anything could work.
I want you to see some of the sparring that went on yesterday when it came to getting rid of all those illegal immigrants on those planes, Cut 8, with Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation.
There was
that
a
had determined what they're
sent
doing.
To a man's prison, and El Salvador said no.
I mean,
so it's
okay.
The question
look,
of if you are
I can't
suspending
speak to those individual
the ability
details
to have
if
a gang
you want
in
to.
Court, that you get the list right.
But
right?
Under,
that you can verify
right,
that
under,
these people are gang members.
Look, every one of them were here illegally. So first of all, we had every right and every and should deport every one of these individuals. If you want to make a special case for one, that's fine. But underlying that is the Alien Act that has determined that Commander-in-Chief has the absolute authority to do this.
So he had to talk right through her multiple times. And she does this little throwaway line like, oh, yeah, that's not true, but we'll move on. He stops her right now, and Rubio does too.
Yeah, look, they started to remind me of the Washington Generals, you know, the basketball team that always loses to the Harlem Globetrotters,
yeah.
Right? That's what Margaret Brennan is coming across as. She's like the stooge who just is there to be defeated.
But in a way, Michael, she does have the highest ratings of the Sunday shows, and she pushes back. You see a disdain that Trump won, but it doesn't matter. At some point, she's got to realize that what I would do if I was doing that Sunday show, and if I really felt as though you know what? I think that Trump's a better president. You have to acknowledge what's working. Border crossings are down 96%. You have four hotspots in the world. He's addressing all four at the same time while building up the military and trying to get our $36 trillion deficit in line. So, and then you might be upset by the practices. But if you want people to pay attention, that's what you should do. And lastly, I want you to weigh in real quick on the Bernie Sanders AOC tour, anti-oligarchy tour. I think this is terrible news for the Democrats because their message has already failed. That woke message that the rich have it too good for too long, that the working class have no say in this country, that the administrations are going to give tax breaks for the billionaires. All that stuff doesn't work. Just because Trump is rich, it doesn't mean the working class doesn't like it. It's just the opposite. I think these big crowds are actually a poison for the Democrats.
I do too. I think it's sort of like a false spring that they've now found their message and their messengers. Really, Bernie Sanders and AOC, this is going to appeal to middle America. This is going to appeal to the working classes in Michigan and Pennsylvania. I don't think so. I mean, socialism, you know, has its appeal to certain dreamy, mostly young people. The Bernie bros were all in their 20s, and I think AOC is cut from that cloth. But I don't think it has a broad appeal to the working class and to the middle class. I think what Donald Trump is doing by reducing the federal debt, I mean, let's not forget, that's the primary thing that DOGE is about. You know, Brian, we are now, out of a $7 trillion budget, we are essentially borrowing $2 trillion. So it's more than 30% of every dollar that we spend is borrowed. And we're passing that debt on to future generations.
And people get upset about cutting.
Yes, that's right. As though every federal spending is sacrosanct in some way. It's helping, it's saving lives. It's ridiculous. It's a lot of it is just encrusted into the budget process, and it's got to be reexamined. I mean, how can you be against reexamining the bloated federal budget?
Beats me. Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. Always great. New York Post columnist. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The idea that Trump has, I don't know what his latest numbers are, he wants to deport 20 million people who are in this country who are undocumented. Well, you do that, you destroy the entire country, because I got news for you. Trump's billionaire friends are not going to pick the crops in California that feed us. They're not going to work in meat packing houses. That's what undocumented people are doing.
But working class people would love an opportunity, not for all those jobs. I'm with Bernie Sanders on that. There's a lot of people here for 20, 30 years that, and I've seen them featured, heard them talk, that don't have documentation and are working in the farms. And they have. I've listened to farm owners talk, and I can only go by their word and what I see. And they say that they cannot get Americans to have their job. I have news for Bernie Sanders, and the senator knows this. They're not getting to that. They're going to get the criminals out first. They're going to get the recent border crossings out also. They're going to get people that have overstayed their visas, and they're going to get people out there who haven't shown up for their court appearances. By the time they got to that, there's going to be more people not coming here and self-deporting. We're going to have the ability to do total immigration reform. Nobody ever thought the border could be shut down like it is now, and we haven't even started to put technology and actually physical border wall continuing. We got 7 miles commissioned. We need another 150.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
There's going to be something else taking place. It's called April 2nd, and that's going to be tariffs. And China will pay and other countries will pay.
Business
We've been ripped off by every country in the world, friend and foe. And on April 2nd, I call it the liberation of America. We've been the fat, dumb, foolish country that allowed everybody to rip us off, including our friends. Look at NATO.
So that is the President of the United States. So we're getting close to April 2nd, where April 2nd is going to be reciprocal tariff day, where everything balances out. Unless someone comes to the table ahead of time and says, I recognize the imbalance and I'm looking to, let's do a compromise here. So with us right now is Gerard Baker, editor-in-large of the Wall Street Journal and host of Wall Street Journal at large on 7:30 on Fridays, and host of the weekly Wall Street Journal opinion podcast, Free Expression. So, the market right now, Jerry, is surging. Why is that?
I think they like this possibility of this new form of tariffs that we're going to get from April the 2nd, Liberation Day, as President Trump says it. They like that a lot better than the tariffs we've seen so far. What President Trump is proposing makes a lot of sense, I have to say, unlike some of the other things he's been proposing on tariffs. The United States, he's right. The United States, broadly speaking, with most of its major trading partners, does have an unequal tariff system. It charges typically on average lower tariffs against the EU than the EU charges against us, against China than China charges against us, against India, against Mexico. Many of these countries, even within the USMCA. So the US, you know, the US is essentially losing out in this tariff battle. What it means, if he's going to, as we reported, as the Wall Street Journal reported today over the weekend, he's going to have a system where we now have reciprocal tariffs. Where so, if the EU is say charging 10% on our on US imports, and the US is charging 3% on average on EU imports, then we're going to level that out, create a level playing field.
And if they want to come back and say, let's make it seven.
One, it's fair. Exactly. One, it's fair. Two, it actually is much less damaging to the US and to the world economy than just saying, I want 25% tariffs here or 40% tariffs there. So it's, I think the market likes this new policy and could well end up liking Trump's international economic policy generally.
So they say that, according to your story in the Wall Street Journal, it says they're going to focus on the G20 nations. They're going to look at Brazil, Canada, China, EU, India, Japan, and focus on the so-called dirty 15, not every single country. But they are going to crack down on the exceptions. Evidently, Trump, in retrospect, thought there was too many exceptions in his first 4 years. He feels as though he wants to be a little bit more heavy-handed.
Yeah, and again, that's, you know, that's not wrong to look at those countries that do look. I mean, we can get into a deep argument about why the US has negotiated all these deals with countries where these trade deals where it ends up with lower tariffs on their goods than they end up with on our goods. And he's partly right that America's been sort of fat and lazy about that. But the more important reason, Brian, is that because of US multinationals with big operations in countries like India and China and elsewhere, US multinationals have lobbied hard with US governments, with Congress and administrations in the past to keep tariffs on those countries low because they're importing. You know, if you're Apple and you've got a huge amount of your supply chain in China, you want tariffs on exports from China to the United States to be relatively low. So, you know, it has benefited the US and US companies too, but overall, President Trump is right. The overall balance has been not in favor of the United States. And so rebalancing that, and you, as you say, Brian, if you get some sort of a compromise, you could even end up with lower tariffs overall, which by and large is good for international capitalism.
And you know, one thing I'm seeing, you know, fentanyl is a big deal and from Canada and Mexico. And Mexico seems to be on the surface a major roundup of would-be cartel members. We know what's happening at the border. It has a lot to do with what's going on at the southern Mexico's southern border. And then in the northern border, I was shocked to see 60 Minutes last night. I thought it was going to be one of these things to prove Donald Trump doesn't know what he's talking about when it comes to problems at the biggest border in the world. And it turns out huge problem, huge industry. And it's the cartels working through the north. And they talk about advertising on Facebook and how they're through different social media apps, people that have died in the process, and also the amount of fentanyl getting through the northern border. I was shocked at that. So there is an issue there. But you say there's a mixed message from the administration when it comes to the reason for the tariffs.
Yeah, I mean, especially on Canada. Look, maybe the official numbers suggest that the amount of fentanyl coming across the border, both sides actually going from the U.S. to Canada and Canada to the U.S., is relatively small compared to Mexico.
South.
I agree. It's still enough to kill lots and lots of Americans, and it's a terrible thing, but it's relatively small compared with Mexico. So, you know, if these tariffs are about that, then I think it's not the right policy approach to impose 20 because the damage mm-hmm. to the U.S. while it's less than the damage to Canada, the damage to U.S. consumers is enormous. I don't think tariffs is the way to deal with it. Find another way to deal with it. But the problem with these tariffs on Canada is we get a different explanation every day, Brian. We get told it's about fentanyl. We're told it's about currency manipulation or trading practices in Canada that are wrong. We're then told that it's because ultimately Donald Trump wants Canada to be the 51st state. Well, you know, that, I mean, A, that's not going to happen, and B, that's certainly not going to help with the fentanyl problem because there isn't even going to be a border then, right? So if the cartels really do control Canada right. and it's about to become the 51st state, then God help us because they're going to control large parts of the United States. So none of that makes any sense. If he sticks to economically sensible policies like with these reciprocal tariffs, you could end up with much more access for American companies to international markets, a much better performance for the U.S. economy, and yeah, American, most important of all, American consumers, American businesses, American producers actually benefiting. And I think, you know, that's the right policy.
Right. I think Trump is happy with the amount of people that have pledged to bring their business back here from Apple on down. And he feels as though we're heading in the right direction with all these pledges from Oracle to build their another power plant here. Here's what he said over the weekend about what he's seeing happen since he took over. And like last time, cut 40.
What has Bezos told you about trying to be more fair in his coverage?
Just that.
Yeah.
He's really trying to be more fair. But he actually did a couple of bad articles at him. He said, this is crazy.
Yeah.
I lose my fortune running this thing. And they, you know, they're out of control. These people are crazy. They're crazy people. They're out of control. And he's actually a very good guy. I got to know him the second time. He was up. If you look at the
And he talks about, the audio's a little bad there. So he talks about Bezos, talks about Zuckerberg, talks about Oracle coming back. He talks about Google and everybody now helping on the defense side where there was persona non grata. You ask Google for any help from the Pentagon, they wouldn't do it. There's such a change in attitude now from Silicon Valley and the sense that they want to work with this president. Where does that come from? Is it just because he's in power or something else happen?
It's because he's in power and these companies want to make money. And, you know, they understand that, you know, that a lot of them have very, very, very lucrative contracts or the potential of lucrative contracts with the U.S. government. As you said, it is a strange state of affairs that Google was run by its employees essentially for a long time, who refused to work on contracts with the Defense Department. Many of these other companies did the same thing. But no, the companies now realize there's a tremendous business opportunity. There is, though, something else, Brian, going on, and I think we are seeing this. We've seen this. you know, people talk about a vibe shift. I don't like the term, but it does capture fairly well what is going on, especially interesting, really interestingly, Brian, among younger people in the country, right? I mean, we've seen some of this really interesting polling about how younger people voted in the election, obviously, how they view Donald Trump, how they view the Democrats in particular. They are turning away from the Democrats in droves. They've, especially young men, have had enough of being told that they're to blame for everything, have had enough of being told they're the villains, have had enough
you
of
don't
being,
want to be masculine.
Being excluded from economic opportunities. They have literally, I mean, you know, there's been some really interesting reporting in the last, just in the last month or so, about how, you know, companies over the last 10 years when we were in the peak of woke nonsense, you know, it was increasingly hard for young white men to get jobs, especially in the creative, in sort of creative industries and technology and things like that.
Yeah, try to get a commercial if you're a white actor.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely.
So Trump yesterday said, you know, Johnson & Johnson announced yesterday it's going to go with tens of billions of dollars and start building and start making stuff here. Apple, $500 billion. We know that we have a pledge from Honda to move their plants out of Mexico. So a lot of this stuff, I guess, to get on Trump's side. The other thing I think, Jerry, is that Biden was so bad for business that it was almost like a relief. That, you know, we're trying to vilify Trump and say he wasn't a legitimate president and he's too volatile and all these things and he's going to be impeached. And then after 4 years of Joe Biden and that ridiculous administration's anti-business attitude, they're welcoming this opportunity.
Mm. Oh, that's no question about that, Brian. You talk to people. One of the reasons so many people in Silicon Valley and the tech field in particular have become sort of Trump supporters or conservatives.
AI especially, right?
Yeah, AI. But, you know, these big tech companies too, and many of the venture capitalists and the investors who were basically being told by the Biden administration, you will do what we say. They saw what happened with Facebook in particular when the Biden administration tried to get them to, you know, essentially to not publish things that were unhelpful in the way that the Biden administration viewed it. They saw the way in which the Biden team were trying to regulate the economy, the tech sector in particular, the way in which it's very aggressive antitrust measures mm-hmm. from the Biden FTC and Justice Department. And they thought, you know, this is going to stifle at a critical moment in America's economic development, when AI is so important and making sure that America remains at the forefront of AI with all this competition from China, we are being led by an administration, the Biden administration, mm-hmm. that is trying to stifle it, stifle innovation and stifle entrepreneurship and stifle our ability to grow. And there they turned against Joe Biden, and that's one of the reasons they vote, that many of them in much greater numbers than before voted for Donald Trump.
Jerry Baker, how do you react to what's happening with the Teslas? With the firebombing of dealerships, with the blowing up of these fleets, with the keying of cars for just normal homeowners, to a big push to divest from their stock. Does it disturb you that someone could work for the government and pay this type of pay this type of price?
Of course, it's absolutely it's despicable, and it's and I hope these people are discovered. I've seen many of these cases of people being caught on camera keying Teslas, and of course,
good news is they have cameras on.
Yeah, they have cameras. I mean, by the way, how idiotic do you have to be to sort of key, you know, in front of a camera? Good, you know, you should be sent to prison for stupidity alone, let alone for violent vandalism. No, it's absolutely indefensible. Look, I think Donald Trump, I think Elon Musk is. I think that, you know, if you don't like Elon Musk, don't buy his cars, right? And we're starting to see that. I mean, especially around the world, some extent in the U.S., but around the world, we're seeing. I mean, his sales are off like 90% in parts of Europe because of the way things he says. That's, you know, you don't have to agree with that. You don't have to like it. But, you know, if you don't like it, if you don't like Elon Musk, then don't, you know, don't contribute to his economic welfare. But violence against in any circumstances, violence is absolutely indefensible. And I hope these people are caught and prosecuted.
When you look at the Tesla stock, and, you know, it is down to what right below where it was before the election.
Down
where do you think long term?
Yeah. I suspect that, look, a lot of this is heavily political, right? He's, again, as I say, particularly in Europe, he's lost a lot of business, you know, because there are competitors too, particularly in Europe. The Chinese EV manufacturers are making real inroads into Europe, and they can do that. Here in the United States, there's also been some political. Look, I suspect that Musk has been a genius with the development of Tesla, with the development of EVs, but I suspect that that's actually no longer his real, where his passion is, where his focus is. I think Starlink, some of the other businesses that he's involved in, again, there are big competitors now. I mean, he led the way with EVs without any question, and he deserves all of the rewards he's got from that. But there are many competitors now, Chinese competitors, some European competitors, American competitors too. So that market is getting much more crowded and much more challenging for him. So I don't suspect that he's all that concerned, even though it's a 50% decline, because I think he has other economic opportunities. As I said, Starlink is an extraordinary beneficiary. The battery, the work that he's been doing on batteries.
What about robotics?
Robotics too. He's got some interesting AI developments too. Look, he's been an entrepreneurial genius, and he will find ways. I think his timing he may have accelerated the decline, if you like, of Tesla as an investment because people don't like what he's doing with Doge. But I think his timing is, you know, once again, is probably very good because it's going to open up opportunities for him in other fields.
How do you feel? You feel like ultimately he'll be a plus or minus for Trump?
I think what he's doing, some of what he's doing in focusing, in trying to shrink the government is good. I don't like the way he's gone about all of it. I think it's been heavy-handed and some things have been done, frankly, that are inaccurate. I think he's a political risk for Trump. Look, I think he brings enormous benefits. One, that in terms of what he's doing, some of the things he's doing with Doge. Two, the influence of X, which is great, and to have a platform like X, which is now dominated, frankly, by the big by more conservative voices, that's very useful for Trump. Also, he is, his money. I know that he's been deploying his money in ways that help Donald Trump, both in the election, both in threatening. I mean, he's getting involved, very much involved in this Wisconsin Supreme Court election. He's indirectly threatening some Republicans who may be feeling like opposing Donald Trump and saying, I'll use that to change you. That's all incredibly beneficial for Trump. There is a downside, which he's not very popular. I mean, if you look at the opinion polls, people are concerned about some of the things he says about Social Security. They're concerned about what they see as possibly some self-dealing going on, that he may end up getting contracts out of this, while some people may worry about losing their Social Security payments. So he's not popular. So it's a balance at the moment. He's doing a lot of good work for Trump. He's being enormously beneficial for Trump. Mm-hmm. But he could be a drag on Trump's approval ratings.
I just find it pretty amazing that we were putting out billing in the country with no idea where the money was going. And he's making it all accountable right away, before the Treasury Secretary was actually confirmed.
Yeah, but he's exaggerating some of the things they've said. I mean, look, the U.S. has a massive fiscal problem, and it's only going to get worse, and we're going to have another big tax cut, we hope, this year. Part of the justification for that tax cut was that we were going to be able to cut some spending. Doge was going to do a really good job. Well, Doge is talking about maybe cutting billions of dollars. We're talking about a deficit of trillions of dollars. So we are, by a factor of at least 1,000, Doge is underperforming in terms of what it needs to do. So, yeah, of course, bringing some streamlined efficiency is very good. Of course, whatever savings Doge can find is valuable. But it's not really doing the job of shrinking the government in the way that the U.S. desperately needs if it's to retain its advantages as a dynamic economy.
Well, put it this way, he's cutting, and people are going crazy that he's cutting anything, let alone maybe not enough, in your view. Wall Street Journal's own Jerry Baker. Jerry, thanks so much. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for
having me. Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So you got a whole lot of good people. Alexandra is extraordinary. I am so impressed by her work in Congress and she inspires young people all over the country.
Would you like to see her join in the Senate?
Right now we have, as I said, just a whole lot of people in the Congress. Okay, Jonathan, thanks.
Wait, I got one more. This is important.
Well, I asked you.
Okay.
You want to do nonsense, do nonsense.
No.
I don't want to talk about inside the Beltway stuff.
What is his problem? I mean, this is just crazy. Bernie Sanders gets a big crowd, 30,000 people waiting for him. ABC goes out there, compounds the success by joining him in the field to talk about the momentum of young socialists and old socialists and talk about the same things that got them, get them election loss after election loss and forced Bernie Sanders by cheating out of the Democratic leadership over the last two election cycles, two of the last three election cycles. They don't want the socialist message, but he sits down, has a friendly meeting with Jonathan Carl, just like a bunch of layups, and says, don't you think she could be a Senate? Would you like to see her run? And he gets up to leave. He says, well, you inside the Beltway stuff, either you think she's this great star, he cites what a star she is in Congress, she doesn't pass anything. She offers no legislation except someone writes her the Green New Deal package that is totally infeasible and was put in under the guise of the Inflation Reduction Act, which almost bankrupt the country, and we're still underneath that web of deception. And he says she's a star. So you think she could be senator? He storms off. Now, we sat back down to finish up the last question, but saying he's not going to run for president. But of course he's not running for president. He's 83. Just bizarre. The worst thing for Democrats is for them to get big crowds. They're going to think that's the way to do things. It's not the way to do things. We don't want the whole woke stuff. We don't hate rich people. They socialists hate rich people.
Excuse me, I'm talking.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. This hour, Jake Steinfeld, Body by Jake, brings us into life trying to rebuild in Los Angeles amidst a governor who'd rather go on a podcast than fix his state and a mayor that's about to be recalled. We'll talk about that. Bhatia Unger Sargon is here, a journalist and author of The Second Class, is in studio, fresh off a very successful, extremely well-watched, well-clicked-on episode of Bill Maher. And I find him as intriguing as anybody on television these days, Bill Maher. Mm-hmm. So, Bhatia, great job on that show. Thanks. You were on with?
I was on with Sam Stein from MSNBC.
Yes.
And also Governor Shapiro, Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania.
Who I thought that would get traction during the week. Governor Shapiro, who talked like a reasonable person. I'm too busy governor of my state to worry about this. But you know what's getting all the traction among Democrats? Bernie and AOC, big crowds out and about. I think that that's a nightmare for Democrats. These are old failed issues, vilifying rich people, talking about woke principles. Donald Trump's there for his billionaire friends. This, I feel like I'm watching a rerun of Happy Days or the Andy Griffith Show. It doesn't work.
You said something so smart. You said they have huge crowds, and that's great for us.
Yeah.
And you're so right, because they look at those crowds, 30,000 people. What's 30,000 people in a country of 360 million? And they think, oh, wow, our message is resonating. And it really isn't. And I think you're so right about that. It is a throwback to a sort of previous version. What they are offering, what they call economic populism on the left,
right,
is raising taxes and then redistributing that and expanding the welfare state so that more Americans who are currently working class would be considered poor and would get government benefits. You know who loves that? Rich leftists. You know who hates that? Working class men. Working class women,
yeah,
who work really, really hard, and they don't want to be called poor, and they don't want a government benefit. They want an economy that protects the value of their labor. That's what Trump is doing. And that's why the Democrats are flailing. Even their view of how to get the working class back is totally, totally catering to the vanity of rich liberals.
So this guy David Shore was on the Ezra Klein Show, a Democrat, a pollster. They're still trying to unwind how they lost. But what's interesting at this point in the election cycle, there's actually candid. There's people being honest. They won't say it this close to the election because they don't want to hurt their side. Listen to this. Cut 37.
I think the most important trend politically of the last 30 to 40 years, both here and in every other country in the world, at least Western country that has elections, has been this story of education polarization. You know, that basically everywhere we've seen highly educated people move to the left and, you know, working class people move to the right. I think a lot of people's analytical error when looking at Trump is that they saw Trump as this kind of reincarnation of, you know, the 1960s of like George Wallace or something, when really I think he was representing this global trend. You could look at a bunch of other countries. You have Marine Le Pen in France. You have, you know, the AfD in Germany. And I think that, you know, people miss that, you know, there was kind of a broader global appeal, this kind of polarization on values.
And he said highly educated people and working class people went to him, and they tried to vilify people for voting for him, which just makes people give the Heisman to those people who are judging them. And I just think that if they keep looking at this election and saying, we didn't lose the popular vote by that much, and we didn't lose those battleground states by that much, instead of saying they lost ground in every state, and they lost every battleground state, and they improved with every element, including women, which they thought they lost, men, as well as black men, and Hispanic votes going higher and higher.
There's a unique kind of emotion that comes over me when I hear people saying these things in liberal spaces, because they tried to cancel me, of course, for saying that the real divide in America is the class divide and not the racial divide back in 2019 and 2020. Like, these were cancelable offenses, which, of course, were true. Now, finally, they're letting it in. So I feel, on the one hand, like, very relieved that people are saying this. And also, I feel like a little bit resentful that the same people who tried to cancel me for saying this are now admitting it. It's so, you're so right, Brian. They try to say Donald Trump is George Wallace. Donald Trump is FDR. The last time an American president made this big of an investment in the dignity of labor, of the working class, was FDR. And they just missed the boat because they are speaking to each other, to other rich liberals.
Yeah, I think that's it's interesting. I also think the whole we cannot take Israel's side too much because we'll alienate the next group of young people. Even the Jewish Americans are a little bit more anti-Israel than before. And Trump says, no, no, I'm pro-Israel. Oh, they need weapons. We're giving them weapons. Oh, and when I asked him directly on the show, I said, what's your message to Netanyahu? He goes, do what you have to do. I mean, that to me is what's backing Israel. Joe Biden would say it, but he's actually doing it. And I think we're seeing that right now with they're looking to finish off Hamas. They said we thought we could diminish them, but now they got to finish them.
We've never had a president who had our backs as Jews like this president. It's just never happened before. Maybe since George Washington, who, you know, he wrote this beautiful letter to the Jews of Newport about how they will always be protected in this country and always have equal rights in this country. You know, Brian, it was harder to be a Catholic or a Mormon or a Quaker in America for much of American history, much harder than it was to be a Jewish person. We've always had equal rights and equal protections here. So, you know, the support that Jews worldwide and American Jews are getting from this president is unfathomable.
So
I mean, it's just beyond.
Let's talk about Columbia. Today, there's protests, more protests on what seems to be an acquiescence by Columbia University on all nine things that the administration was demanding, including a change to take away the curriculum, ability to write the curriculum for Near East and Far East and Middle East in at Columbia, and now it's going to be on a separate provost. We'll decide what these kids are going to learn. They're also got to take their masks off. They're going to empower campus police in order to arrest people and clear out buildings and allow cops to come on. It looks like they gave in on everything because they're desperate to get their $400 million back. They're also cracking down. Here's what Caroline Levitt told me on One Nation on Sunday night, Cut 47.
These universities have expressed a willingness to own up to the mistakes of the past, but the president has been very clear in what he wants to see from these colleges and universities. They will not receive federal funding if they allow men and women's sports. They will not receive federal funding if they side with Hamas and terrorists over Jewish American students who are paying a lot of money to go to these fine institutions and deserve to be protected and feel safe when they go into their classrooms. And the actions that we have seen from these universities leaders and these professors has been unacceptable to this president, and that's why he has threatened federal funding. We have seen the universities come to the table. The Trump administration continues to correspond with them, but the president has made his fine lines very clear.
So your thoughts about that, and also $175 million from the University of Pennsylvania. How does that ripple through elite institutions?
I very proudly endorse the president. I made a video and wrote an article about why American Jews should support this president. If you had told me before the election, could any president reform the absolutely disgusting, godless culture on American elite institutions and campuses, I would have said to you it's impossible. And now you see that simply by withholding $400 million, which, by the way, to these universities is nothing. They have endowments that are worth $40 billion. Just withholding $400 million, President Trump brought them to their knees.
Yep.
It's absolutely amazing. And it's funny, when Bill Maher had me on, the first question he asked me was, he was like, don't you regret supporting the president? And I think liberals are living in this fantasy. CNN keeps airing like regretful Trump voters. I don't know where they're finding them. They cannot fathom like how elated we are at how things are going in terms of foreign policy, in terms of domestic policy, in terms of the economy. And then again, looking at universities in terms of things I thought were unfixable.
Look at immigration, down 96% of the border. Look at it. So let's talk about this guy, Mahmoud Khalil. they decided to put a little bit more out there today because I guess he's going to have a hearing this week. He said he has violated his application for a visa. He did not disclose his work with UNRWA or his push for divesting from Israel. He's part of that apartheid movement. He failed to list the continuing employment with a Syria office in the British embassy because he's a refugee from Syria, that war-torn country. And they're trying to push back on just, and by the way, Andy McCarthy says they shouldn't even have to say that. The Secretary of State wants you out and you violated your green card and your visa. You should be gone. But this is just the beginning. He's got to get out. Listen to what his wife said. Cut 46.
You also know that the press secretary said that your husband circulated pro-Hamas flyers. Did he?
That's not true.
Is Mahmoud pro-Hamas?
These are accusations that the Trump administration keeps pushing on him.
But what do you say to those?
I think it's ridiculous. It's disgusting that's what they're resorting to, that's the tactic that they're using to make him look like this person that he's not. Literally, it's so simple. He just does not want his people to be murdered and killed. He doesn't want to see little kids' limbs being blown off, you know?
So is he pro-Hamas or not? We don't know, do we?
She didn't say no, did she, Brian?
Nope.
Very interesting.
Put him under oath and ask him that question.
She couldn't even bring herself to say no. I'm really speechless. When I saw that clip, I was like, wait a minute. I watched it twice. I said, did she really not say no, he doesn't support Hamas? She didn't. And what's amazing is, you know, the journalist asked her from CBS, asked her, is it true that he was handing out leaflets? We saw footage of him handing out those leaflets. We have seen
that would be a nice follow-up question.
Exactly. We've seen footage of him saying the Palestinians have a right to armed resistance. Guess what? There has never, ever been a version of Palestinian armed resistance that didn't target civilians, ever. Palestinian armed resistance is terrorism, and he supports it. We know that the group that he represents came out in support of October 7th. You know, there are 1 billion people on this planet, probably 2 billion, who would give their right arm for a green card to this country. We have a right to say,
goodbye.
If you support Hamas, you don't get one of those.
And there's another guy at Cornell University. I'm sure there's a ton at Cornell University, but one in particular is his name is Tal. He was suspended twice last year and knew his visa would be terminated if he continued to protest against Israel. But he's still fighting his deportation at this hour. He's got an attorney. He says that the case is weak against him. But Fox News confirmed the pro-Palestinian Cornell student activist asked to surrender to ICE, and he did. So he's got to be gone. There's a professor over at Georgetown. He's got to be gone. He came out pro-Palestinian. This is beginning to hopefully ripple through everywhere. But here's the bigger question, Bhatia. Why are they in to begin with? What was it about his application that was better than a kid in Iowa or a kid in San Antonio that we have to get the Syrian refugee in England protest who lives in London? I don't know on whose dollar. He gets to go to Columbia and live in New York City. Who wrote that check?
That's a really great question. And I just want to address the free speech argument because I was convinced by it initially, I have to say. I felt that there was, you know, there is a free speech argument here. He is being deported for his views. But also there's an immigration issue. And I'll tell you what finally convinced me that this was an immigration issue. First of all, the lying to get the visa. I mean, that's like an instant, right, violation of your green card. But it was also, if you accept the argument that the free speech people are making, what they're effectively saying is we don't have the right to deny a person citizenship in America based on their views because of free speech. And that's, of course, insane.
Yep.
Of course, we have a right to choose who our neighbors are going to be. And a green card is effectively a trial run. Do we like you enough to give you the greatest privilege on God's green earth, which is to be an American citizen?
How about this? If there were protests on Columbia of the KKK wearing masks. So how long would those protests last? They took over buildings of KKK and they say, let's get rid of black people. Do you think we'd say, well, they're free speech and those are nice hats? Would we do that? Not in a second. They wouldn't be talking about free speech there, would they?
No, definitely not. And that's why what the president did with, you know, by withholding this $400 million from Colombia was brilliant, because he effectively said, this is private property. You get money from us. We have certain expectations, and those expectations involve not discriminating against Jews, not allowing lawless occupation of your buildings. You have to enforce the law here. You cannot choose not to because it's private property. It was just brilliant, a brilliant move.
Well, we're going to see a few more minutes with Bhatia, and then we'll find out what's going on in California with Jake Steinfeld, who might just be running for governor. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We are back. Bhatia Unger-Sargon. We have a few more minutes left, Bhatia, but I thought George Clooney over the weekend on 60 Minutes sat down. One of the questions was, hey, what about that editorial you run that really forced Joe Biden from the race? Was Obama behind it? You want to hear it?
Yeah.
Here's his answer.
Looking back on that, happy you did it?
Yeah. I'll make it kind of easy. I was raised to tell the truth. I had seen the president up close for this fundraiser, and I was surprised. And so I feel as if there was a lot of profiles and cowardice in my party through all of that. And I was not proud of that. And I also believed I had to tell the truth.
Your thoughts, Bhatia, on that?
I want to make sure that your audience understands, like, why it was so disgusting what George Clooney just said. Because that fundraiser was before the debate. If I'm remembering the timeline correctly, mm-hmm. there was a fundraiser. Then about 3 weeks later, there was the debate. And then a few weeks after that was the op-ed from George Clooney. Meaning when he alone had access to this information due to the fact that he's a celebrity, millionaire, funder, elite of the Democratic Party, he did not tell the American people what he had witnessed. He waited until the American people saw it for themselves and then pulled out the knife and stabbed President Biden in the back because he knew that it was over for him. This is the most cowardly thing I've ever seen in my life. So President Obama wouldn't put his name on the op-ed, right? He made George Clooney do it, right?
He says that wasn't Obama.
Says it wasn't Obama. Fine. Right. Okay, whatever, right? You know, but that is who the Democratic Party is right now. It's like Obama and Clooney. It's like millionaires who are lecturing people, hiding what they know, gatekeeping the truth until the American people turn on them. And then there is no person who is close enough to them that they will not stab in the back to keep power. This is the definition of cowardice.
So here's how clueless this party is. Biden, a couple of days ago, said, I'm willing to come back and help with Jill and raise money. Like anybody wants him, this diminished state that he was with the auto pen story, that he might not have been calling the shots for 3 years, another book's about to come out. And he is so angry at the party, and the party is angry at him, but they're talking at each other. It's like neither one of them understands what they've done to their side and what they did over the last 4 years that alienated so many.
It's so, so, so sad. I can't help but I know he was a terrible president, but can you imagine being this person who was elevated and lied to by this totally craven party that has no values left and no ability to stand up to the crazy radicals in on its left flank,
right,
or to its Soros billionaire funders? And so he's elevated and then just completely discarded like yesterday's garbage when he embarrasses them by revealing to the American people how godless right. a party they
and
are.
And here's a full circle. You know why they put him forward? Because Bernie Sanders was about to win the nomination and Clyburn was desperate. And he said, if you redo your staff, I'll make you the guy. And he essentially got anointed by the power in him. And Bernie Sanders is hot again. And Joe Biden can't get a call returned. Bhatia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, I'll talk to you again
Thank
soon.
Thank you so much, Brian.
All right, we talk a little about Los Angeles with Jake Steinfeld in the moment.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
California's projected to lose 3 seats, New York 2, also going to lose a seat, Minnesota, Oregon, Rhode Island, Illinois, all blue states. Who's getting these? Texas, Florida, Idaho, and Utah. I mean, this looks like game over.
You know, and the reason why people are voting with their feet is a lot of what your book is about. Taxes and regulation. I certainly have been screaming about it forever. I did 3 years with a sign here that said, how long is it going to take me to get my solar hooked up? 3 years. Talking about it on television in this state. You couldn't do it. This state has almost 400,000 regulations. I just put in a new roof because the fire, I thought, oh, let's get a roof that's not going to burn up. Two inspections. Why are you inspecting my roof? It's my f***ing roof. If it falls on me, that's my problem. And we're taxed more than any other state. People are leaving these kind of states for places where they're not let they feel the heavy breath of government on them. It's just, it's not that hard for Democrats to understand this, but they seem to be incapable of doing anything about it.
That's Democratic host Bill Maher. You know his voice. He's going to be visiting with Trump next week because Kid Rock said, I want to bring this country together. We're both friends. I know the president. You don't. You suit each other. You say a lot of things that President Trump agrees with, so I'm going to bring you down, and we'll see what happens. Look, Bill Maher's probably going to speak his mind to the president, too, and they might even get ticked off and end the meeting abruptly, but they do agree on a lot. Jake Steinfeld is here, buddy by Jake, great friend of the show, chairman of the National Foundation for Governor's Fitness. And, Jake, you were nodding, saying, no kidding, because you're in Los Angeles. You lost everything, Pacific Palisades.
Yep. Yes.
And now you're in the midst of, it's been a couple of months now, and you're trying to just rebuild your house. And you are fuming. You're a guy who's used to being in control of things. But now you're in the susceptible to the city.
First of all, great to be here, Brian.
Yeah, welcome.
And on a lighter note, man, congratulations of all the great success that you're having. St. Louis, I saw some video.
So good you said that. 97-1. Yeah, 97-1 did a great job getting the word out.
But you're doing it. You know why, man? You speak the truth. You have a great time doing it. And you talk to people. And people just want to be spoken to and spoken with. That's really the name of the game. What Bill just said there, I didn't know that clip was coming on. I thought you and I were talking about a whole bunch of things. But he's 1,000% right. You know, the president came to Pacific Palisades, which was my town, right? I'm born in Brooklyn, New York, raised in Baltimore, Long Island. You and I are neighbors in Long Island, man. I went to California when I was 18 years old to follow a dream. You know, California is that place where dreams come true. Unfortunately, today, that dream has gone up in smoke, both literally and figuratively. And what happened to my world, you can't even imagine. We talked about it. I came on it 2 days after my house burned down. I'm much better. And I said, not a pity party for me. But what's gone on there is disgusting. And like what Bill just said, in order to get a permit to do something, it takes you weeks and months and sometimes a year to rebuild, to do something, to put a roof on something. It's insane, Brian. It's just insane. And it's got to stop. Because that dream of California and what California was and what it is today is just not there.
Right. Because little things. And I did not know. Well, no, not every house in your block burned down.
As a matter of fact, the entire Palisades, for the most part, burned down in my 600, in my neighborhood, in my little neck of the woods there. Our home was the only house that burned on our street. And a couple of houses down in the 700 block, another home burned. And then it skipped.
Yeah.
But we wanted to, first of all, the psychological damage alone, when you're staring at that burnt metal and whatever it was, it is psychologically, it kills you, man. It kills you minute by minute. And I wanted to scrape that land as quick as I could. And to go through, as my grandmother would say, the Mishigas that you have to go through to get it done, I said, screw it. I'm going to follow the rules, right? I got the testing done. The EPA came out. They did the test. They gave me the green thumb, right, which meant I can go to second stage, phase two, which meant that now you can opt in or opt out for the Army Engineer Corps for them to scrape your land, right? The thing that you don't know, they say it's free, except if you have insurance. And if you have insurance, they max out your insurance.
So get this. For the people who couldn't afford or chose not to or didn't get covered, they're going to get paid by the federal government.
Right.
And the ones who were paying the insurance premiums every single month, so you're being penalized.
We were being penalized, but more importantly, they only did half the job. They will only do half the job. And then what they'll do is they don't take enough soil. They don't take the concrete. They don't take pools, right? they lay it on you. But that's, by the way, that's okay. We all big people. We all understand what you have to do. And it happens quick and fast because no one thought about losing their home.
Yep.
No one thought about your house catching on fire and it's gone. And it's happened to millions of people before me. It'll happen to a lot of people after me. What I'm crazy over is what happens when it's done. Now, by the way, we're off the front page and been off the front page now, and people go back to normal, which is what human nature is all about. Right? There's a lot of other catastrophes and tragedies going on minute by minute here in this great world that we live in and this great country we live in. But we and the people of California now in Los Angeles and really the Palisades, Pasadena, we lost our homes, and we're still and we'll still be dealing with it for many years to come. And you have to make change. It really has to make change, because you hear the mayor and the governor, all they're chirping about is we're at light speed. Things are at light speed. I say, come on out. Come on out and take a walk, and take a walk with me, Bri, and I'll show you. And like I said to you when all this went down, use me as the guinea pig now, because I'm going to show you that we're going to make change, and it's and we will rebuild. I want to rebuild in that same, my address on that street. My kids grew up there. We were there for 30 years in that house. We love the Palisades and love that neighborhood. It's a community. It's as much as a community as it was when I grew up in New York. And it's hard sometimes to find a neighborhood, right, in California. And we found one. And I don't want to lose it.
And we'll see how many people get back, and then what you can be able to do, and the speed in which it's going to be done. And is the environmentalists going to overwhelm, and the and these mayors and governors, both are being recalled, by the way. The mayor, it's getting serious, because she's the most incompetent person I've ever seen. Kevin McCarthy was on with me Sunday night at 10 o'clock on One Nation, and he used to be the congressman from California, and he knows everybody so well. Former speaker, listen to what he said. Cut 36.
He is the largest chameleon that has ever
lived. This is about your
governor. He stands for nothing. He's not the governor of California. He's not doing his job. Just this week, Californians are now going to have to borrow billions of dollars to pay for Medi-Cal because he went out to give Medi-Cal for illegals. And you watch on his podcast, he's criticizing what he actually did. It makes no sense. It just shows President Trump not only won the presidency, he has broken the Democrats.
But is it enough to get people angry enough in a very blue city like Los Angeles to say, I can't keep doing things the same? It's not okay for a governor to come in and say, I want to get answers.
I think so. Yeah,
it's not okay for a governor to say, all the money, I have to tell you, he's got to take out billions of dollars loans because one of the reasons is he promised illegal immigrants to get the same coverage as you.
The thing is this, you know, you push people far enough.
Yeah.
You break somebody down deep enough. You burn somebody hot enough. Change happens. And change is beginning to happen. Listen, I'll tell you this, Brian. I never, you know, I'm friends with Arnold. I've known Arnold since I'm 18 years old.
Former governor, he hired you to run the California Fitness.
I was chair of the Fitness Council in California. It was a great honor for me because Arnold served as in that position, you know, for under Pete Wilson, you know, and it was a great honor. And I think he's a great guy. He's been a friend to me for a long time. I know Maria for a long, long time, too. My wife, Tracy Doze, we know those guys. And not that you know me, right? I'm very blessed in my life. I love my family. I love my kids. There needs to be change. I know what I can do. I know what I've done in my life. Listen, as an entrepreneur, here's what I've learned. I've learned that you don't know everything, because if you think you do, you become a legend in your own shower, you know? But if you get the right people around you, and I've seen what the president has done, and especially in the second term, he's gotten the right people around him in each different part of the government across the board. You break things, of course you got to break things for change.
Mm-hmm.
But change happened. Change is rough and change is tough.
Change is happening
right
now.
But when you have the right motivation and the right inspiration and the right tools, that's when change could happen. And this is something that I've been talking to people. I was in D.C. the last couple of days. I'm here in New York. I'm going back home tomorrow. I'm meeting with a lot of different people. And there's a good, strong interest that if the interest is right and we see an opportunity, there's a good chance that I'm going to run for governor of California.
Wow. How close are you to making that decision?
there's a few meetings that I want to take. There's a few people I want to meet. You know, I've done enough in my career. And everyone said, listen, I love the fact when people count me out. I was the fat kid with the bad stutter growing up. You know, I couldn't stand up in a class when I was in fourth grade and fifth grade. A teacher would say, read out loud. You know, I could read, but I got so nervous and uptight that the words wouldn't come out. And I pushed myself through. The bar was always set low. You know, there's a bodybuilder who stutters. Well, that guy's not too bright. I came to understand and use that to my benefit. Walk into a room when the bar is set low, they don't expect anything from you. So when everyone's going left, I went right. And I've been able to build. Look, I've succeeded. I've lost. But I understand how to talk to people.
Yep.
And understand long enough that you got to get the right people in the right positions. And if I can do that, because I know how to lead and I know how to talk to people.
We got to get a campaign team first, right?
We're talking to people. We're having conversations. And we just want to see, I want to see,
right?
You know, not putting money into this thing because, listen, I came from the infomercial business, right, where I had to buy time, but my time made money. And if it didn't, we didn't spend money on that product. I'm not going to run and put my own money into something because I don't need to want to buy my way into anything. We want to run on a merit and run on the fact that, listen, there is a dream that was California. And I want to bring that back in the right way with the right people for in the middle of the road because I'm not about red or blue. I'm about red, white, and blue. I run as a Republican.
And the Republican Party has done – they haven't done much. I mean, they didn't do anything for Steve Garvey that I could see.
Right.
I know. Plus, he didn't work hard. I mean, the guy was not doing any interviews.
Right.
He had a huge name recognition, never did anything before.
And a really good guy, too. I mean, Steve is – I mean, I knew Steve back in the day.
Work.
Yes,
you got to go 7 days a week, multiple things.
Listen, and I will tell you, you know, I've been from Barstow to Riverside and everywhere from the ocean to the mountains and everywhere in between in the great state of California, putting fitness centers in elementary and middle schools, traveling up and down the state as I've done.
The thing is, you know more governors than anyone else in the country, perhaps,
outside
someone who's a governor, because you've dealt with all governors in one election, lost like more than 50 governors.
Right.
Because you put fitness centers. Centers
right.
in the schools in all 50
all
states.
All 50 states
so
now.
What did you notice about those governors that intrigued you and about how they described the job?
Let me tell you something. One guy that really intrigued me was our mutual friend now that I introduced you to, my friend Doug Burgum, right? Doug was a governor of North Dakota. For some reason, I stood next to 48 of all 50 governors, and Doug and I hit it off. And I love the fact of how he was there because I watched. Because, listen, we go to – elementary and middle schools. And I would tell each governor, now remember, you know, you're talking to kids, no political speeches. I know there'll be some cameras there. And a lot of these governors, no names.
Still got into it.
They just got into it. And they're talking to 7 and 8 and 10 year olds who are wiggling their hands and their feet. And they don't have interaction with kids. They don't have interaction with parents. And it's kind of like they're above it. And I would see this and I would think, how does a guy like this become governor?
Well, it's a businessman.
Right? And I look at a guy like Doug who was incredible. I remember a great moment. We did a fitness center, a Don't Quit Fitness Center, on the Sioux Nation in North Dakota. And there was a chief stood up and came up and had Doug stand up, talked about the pipeline and whatever it was. And he had everyone in the school come up and like lay a hand on Doug. And I thought it was just an amazing moment. Mm-hmm. And he and I kind of hit it off, and we've been pals ever since.
So he could coach you through this?
I mean,
while he's also trying to run the interior of the country.
That's right, which is
the biggest agency.
It's a big agency.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's incredible. I was with him the other day, and he's just a great guy and a great choice for the president.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you want to rebuild L.A., he'd be the one to help you do that.
Absolutely.
Because according to reports, California is still inside the country.
It is.
Right.
It definitely is. And I want to make sure we keep it there. And I definitely want to keep it there. And the thing is, we want to do it the right way with the right people. And with the right people, we're going to get it done.
So you're thinking about running for governor, Jake Steinfeld.
I am thinking about it. Let me just say that. I'm absolutely thinking about it.
All right. We're going to take a break and come back. Jake Steinfeld's here, Body by Jake. He also managed through this to see in fantastic shape still. No excuse not to work out.
No,
just because you have no belongings.
Nothing.
Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
All right, we are back. Jake Steinfeld in studio, body by Jake. We're just talking about, Jake just made news saying if you're really thinking about seriously running for governor. We had Steve Hilton in here. He knew of you, wants to meet you. He wants to run for governor, so he might be an opponent of yours. I'm trying to think who else would actually run. Maybe Rick Caruso? Any of these guys intimidate you?
No, not at all. Yeah. Listen, I think like
would you run as
else,
a Republican?
Yes, I would. Yeah, absolutely.
Have you contacted the party?
Yep. No, I have not. Right. I have not contacted anybody. I'm talking. This is you and I. We have these conversations, and I've been telling you, right? I've been having these meetings, and people have reached out to me from the first since day. What was it? I came on the show January 8th or 9th, whatever it was. My house had just burned down. Mm-hmm. And I came on because you guys have been great to me.
Right.
The show has been great to me since 2000, right? We've been coming on. I've been on the show.
Right. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
People have reached out. I've been meeting with a lot of people. I'm not obviously going to rush this thing. I don't want to do it. There's no vanity reason for doing this, you know. I've checked with the boss. I mean, my wife says if you want to do this, she's been side by side with me. Been married 37 years to Tracy, and I trust everything that she says and does, and she's been great. And our kids are like, Dad, if you think this is what you want to do, we're standing right with you. So it's in there. There are these incredible signs I just showed you during the break.
Tell everyone.
So we lost our home, the house burned down, and we have found. You know, we tried to go back to try to find rings, Tracy's wedding ring. We couldn't find anything. We uncovered one thing. There was there's some broken pots or something that we found. The one thing that was intact, and I'm showing this to you, Brian. Oh, you shoot this thing for when you do this, right? So there was a tray that was given to me, right? You know, my motto was don't quit, right? But this tray that was given to me, and on it, it says, this is the only thing we found. If you're going through hell, keep going.
Right. Winston Churchill. And that's the only thing that survived.
It's the only thing. I'm telling you, it's the only thing that survived.
Wow.
And I look at this just like I do with the poem, Don't Quit. The last two lines are, stick to the fight. When your hardest hit, it's when things seem worst that you must not quit.
Right.
And my feeling is, don't quit on you or your family, and don't quit on this great country of ours.
Right, and use your power to rebuild things and cut through the red tape. And unfortunately, other people got to do that.
You're going to watch me do it.
Right.
Step by step. We're going to do it with you and the audience. You guys have been great.
Okay.
I love what you're doing every day. Peace. Don't
quit.
Thanks,
Jake. Fox News Audio presents the Fox Nation Investigates podcast, Evil Next Door, exploring the life and crimes of five serial predators from across the United States. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.